Okay, Proverbs 14. We left off with verse 12 last week, just to read it and go back over it and then lead into verses 13 through 15. Verse 12, there's a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. And we talked about some of that in our last lesson. It makes me think of the time, the period of the judges, when every man did what was right in his own eyes. And they just sort of came up with their own rules. They didn't follow God's rules. They didn't worry about spiritual rights and wrongs. They just did whatever felt right to them. And when you read something like that, and then you read the newspaper, I was reading an article Les just handed me. The world seems to be doing the exact same thing. Whatever's right in their own eyes, that's what they do. And if anyone stands against it, what's the response? Immediately attacked for standing against any of these ideas. But this warning is still true. There's a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. It doesn't matter how many people vote for it. It doesn't matter how many people approve it. If it's not God's way, it's wrong every time. And I need to be willing to stand up and accept that. Now let's take verses 13 through 15 and look at them as a section. Even in laughter, the heart may sorrow, and the end of mirth may be grief. The backslider in heart will be filled with his own ways, but a good man will be satisfied from above. The simple believes every word, but the prudent considers well his steps. So, verse 13, all of them together. The godly man considers his steps. He doesn't just react to whatever his desires tell him that he should want. What is a backslider? Let's talk about that.
Somebody who had once known better and didn't go back to their old ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's a descriptive word that makes a lot of sense. You were once here, and then you started sliding away from wherever you were. And the here would be God, would be pleasing in God's sight, and godly in way, in different ways, but sliding away from Him, moving away from Him. Another word that we see used in the New Testament, or a phrase that describes that, is falling away. Same idea. One who falls away, one who backslides. It says he may be filled with mirth. Verse 13, even in laughter the heart may sorrow, and the end of mirth may be grief. So there may be a time where the one falling away from God has laughter and he has mirth. But what's going to be the ultimate end to that? Yeah, it's not going to end well. In death, all of that laughter is going to end. It's not going to be funny anymore. It's going to turn to grief, and grief eternally. Verse 15. The simple believes every word, but the prudent considers well his steps. The simple, the naive. We need to be wary about what we believe. We need to be careful, because there are a lot of people teaching a lot of different things. And unfortunately, in the religious world, and I remember being this way, if someone stood in a pulpit and taught it, I just assumed it was right. I mean, I didn't. Why would I think any different, right? And then you start studying the Bible for yourself and realize that's not right. That's not even close. And so there's a warning here against being naive, against being simple. And that means just swallowing down anything anybody tells you. What do we need to do when anything from God's Word is taught or claimed? Yeah, check it. I think of the Bereans. They did that in front of Paul the Apostle. They checked him to make sure he was right against Scripture. And Paul didn't have a problem with it. The Holy Spirit actually commends them for it and calls them noble, more noble-minded. So certainly it's a good quality. It's one we need to have. Bobby.
Well, I have a paper that I forgot, left it in the truck, where a newspaper. Well, this young fellow said he was told by three different preachers that homosexuality was not a sin. So he believes it. And see, if we don't study, some of us might start believing, or some of our children.
Sure. Yeah, it's going to be easier and easier, because anytime you turn on a television, that's what's going to be taught. That's what's going to be shown. So, and it's not only enough to know right and wrong. I need to know where I need to know where to find it. Because if someone asks me, I don't need to give them the answer. Well, the Bible teaches that it's wrong. And then when they say, really, where? Well, I don't know, but it's in there. That doesn't do a whole lot of good. I need to know, and know well enough to be able to show. I need to know that I can go to Romans chapter 1 and show a New Testament description of what God thinks of homosexuality. I need to know these things. I need to know that I can go and look at the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah and reference it there. We need to know more than just yes and no. We need to know where and be able to show it from God's Word. Good point, Bob. Chuck?
There are a lot of congregations nowadays that more or less have fluff teaching, where the people that go to these congregations only want to hear the good things. So this simple believes everything, that's sort of the mindset of ignorance is bliss.
And I don't remember who, it was Bobby, who said, even if we don't fall for it, our children might. What if you have children who are brought up for 20 years on fluff? No substance, no take a stand, no stand in the gap, just fluff. What are they going to do when a hard issue comes? Yeah, they may not even realize it's an issue. They may just swallow it whole and accept it. But if they have to stand against it, they're not going to be used to doing that. And they're just going to accept it or be quiet and just roll over. And that is a danger, certainly in the church. It's a danger really for the whole nation in so many different levels. Norris.
You know, those things like what Bobby's talking about, you know, those things need to kneel from the beginning. So, you know, God can just, you know, I mean, those are not things that Jesus just talked about in the New Testament. You know, God can kneel from the beginning. So.
Yeah.
You know, those are things that we know that the Bible teaches from, you know, from the existence of the world that they were wrong.
And there hasn't been a change from him. He hasn't seen any revelation, and he's not going to, changing what he said on it. So what does that mean? It means the old rules are still the same. Until he decides to change them, and he's told us that this is it. This is the revelation for the final age, so he's not going to change it. So if he doesn't change it, who else has authority to? Nobody, and I certainly don't. So I've got to take what he said, regardless of whether it's popular or not. Bob.
Young people are going to face it because even in the school, the one thing they tell them they have to be tolerant. Well, we don't have to be tolerant when it comes to what God says.
Yeah, and that's the thing, and it's twisted. Certainly, if you don't tolerate everything, you are called one who hates. You must hate somebody. Is that true? Is disagreement hate?
No.
You ever disagree with your parents? Your parents have disagreed with you. Mine have. Do they hate me? Did they hate me? Is that why they disagree with me? No, that's ridiculous. You ever disagree with your spouse? You hate them? No. See, it's ridiculous when you put it. Just disagreeing with somebody doesn't mean you hate them. You may be disagreeing with them because you love them and you're trying to save them from some trouble. And yet that's not what our society says. Our society says, oh no, if you disagree with me, it's because you're a hate monger. That's not true. And one of the things is, when I teach truth, when you teach truth on this, we need to be kind. And we need to show love. It doesn't mean you roll over. I mean, you don't just accept whatever. You teach truth. But do it with a desire to see a soul saved, not to be condescending and talk down to anybody. We do need to be careful about our tone and the motivation behind it. But truth is truth, and I can't change that. I have to teach the same thing that he teaches. Good. Any other thoughts on this idea?
One other little thing in that article that I handed you, and to say nothing, still to say something.
Yes. Yep. Yep. To not act is an action. If I just sit around and do nothing, I've thrown my support in with the other side. And if I say nothing, it's just like voting yes and saying that it's fine. And that's one of the things that I think that we may do. Because many of us, we don't like to be confrontational. We don't like to get in arguments and stuff like that. But sometimes you've got to stand up, whether it's comfortable or not. Sometimes it has to be done. So. Good point, Lynn. Okay. Good. Let's move on. 16 through 19. Let's read that section. A wise man fears and departs from evil, but a fool rages and is self-confident. A quick-tempered man acts foolishly, and a man of wicked intentions is hated. The simple inherit folly, but the prudent are crowned with knowledge. The evil will bow before the good and the wicked at the gates of the righteous. So, just sort of a general statement about those verses. Wise people fear evil and depart from it. There's nothing macho or honorable about messing around with sin just to see if you can handle it. That is absolutely foolish. Genesis 39, Joseph. How did Joseph respond to sin? He feared it. I mean, just call it what it is. Joseph was afraid of what would happen if he had involved himself in sin with Potiphar's wife. Is there anything ungodly or weak about Joseph in that? That's a wise man. And he's a young man. And, you know, a lot of times you would think that a young man particularly might struggle with that kind of situation. Joseph is wise. He fears. First of all, he realizes that the sin would be against God. And that, I think, is the key to understanding why he does what he does. But in addition to that, he fears the sin. He fears the consequences of it. And so he gets away from it. He literally runs away from it. We need to fear sin as well. Godly people who were once godly, have fallen away because they underestimated the lure of sin, or they overestimated their ability to resist it. We can do that, and never tell ourselves that we can't. That we need to be careful when temptation comes and when sin is around. Any comments? Verse 17. Quick-tempered man acts foolishly. A man of wicked intentions is hated. This is, those who cannot control their temper will ruin their lives. They will ruin their lives with foolish actions, because that out-of-control temper, it'll cause us to chase after selfish ways. It'll cause us not to listen and not to get the whole story. It'll cause us just to make these snap, rash decisions and act with poor judgment, and it leads to foolishness. As it says in verse 17, he acts foolishly, a man of wicked intentions is hated. People don't want to be around you when you can't control your temper either, and when you have wicked intentions. No, nobody wants to share in that. Godly people, at least, certainly don't. Good. We've talked somewhat about the naive. Verse 18 again talks about the simple inheriting folly. That's us if we blindly walk into traps. And we, instead of looking around and paying attention to sin and temptation, we just kind of blindly walk right into it. That's naive, and that's foolishness. The simple inherit folly. You see it a lot in the Old Testament. You see it in the New Testament too. The idea of being watchful or being on guard. What does that mean? What does the watchful Christian do?
Watch what we believe, watch what somebody else teach, watch what we say, watch what we do.
Yeah. If you have somebody on guard, if they're any good, what are they going to be like?
Like a shepherd of a flock.
Yeah. They are diligent, and they are alert, and they are cautious, and they're the opposite of naive. They don't just blindly stumble into things. They are sharp and they are crisp, and they are watching for any signs that anything might be out of order. Some people may call you paranoid for that, but I mean, look, if you were a guard whose job it was to guard a city wall, how seriously, if you were committed to it, how seriously would you take it? Why?
It's your job. You're supposed to do it.
This is what you've been given to do. This is your responsibility. What are some other reasons? People will die if you don't do your job, right? What happens if spiritually we don't place a guard? We don't watch like we should. We'll lose our souls. And other people might too because of that. It is very, very serious. We can't afford to be naive and foolish and just sort of stick our head in the sand and let things go. We need to be watchful. Chuck.
Would it not be better to be prepared and have everything covered and taken care of, even if you don't need it, than to need it and not have it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So you're too watchful at this moment. Well, what happens when another one comes? And what if you start slacking off? We need to be diligent and watchful at all times. Absolutely. Bob?
Good. Being watchful. If you've ever been in the military and find yourself in a minefield, you don't know what to watch for.
Yeah.
And you have to watch where you put your foot.
Yeah. Okay, good. One more point with that section 19 is the idea that ultimately the wicked will bow before the righteous. A lot of times in this life it doesn't seem to be that way. It seems that the wicked get their way and they get what they want. But ultimately, and certainly at the very least at judgment, the wicked are going to bow right before they're cast out into eternity. They will bow before the Lord. And while the righteous are able to stay in His presence forever and enjoy that reward, the wicked will be cast out. So the righteous will be taken care of. Even when it may seem like things aren't fair in this life, don't lose trust in that. God will take care of His people. He absolutely will. And when sometimes we wonder why hard times come and why do these things happen? Why are we having to stand up and fight this hard fight? Why? I don't always know the answer. But why did Paul and Peter... did they have to fight some hard fights?
Yeah.
Ended up dying for the cause of Christ. Why?
Because the devil goes about like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour.
Absolutely. They died holding true to their faith. Did that help anybody? Helps me. If they're willing to do it, certainly it should be an encouragement to us to be able to stand firm whatever happens, whatever comes. So keep this in mind. They will not be victorious in the end. It may seem like it on the short term, but God knows His people. He'll take care of them. Good. Let's look at 20 and 21 together. The poor man is hated even by his own neighbor, but the rich has many friends. Now you need to take that with 21 to get the whole context. He who despises his neighbor sins, but he who has mercy on the poor, happy is he. So the poor man is hated by his neighbor. But we're told in 21, someone who despises his neighbor does what? Okay, so this is talking about a wicked neighbor. This is talking about someone in sin. The poor is despised by a wicked neighbor. Because we're told in various other places that the poor, we are not to despise those who are poor. Actually, mark your places and go to James 2 and get a New Testament passage to go with this. James here warns against the idea of showing partiality towards someone because they're rich over someone who might be poor. Chapter 2, verse 1. My brethren, do not hold the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with partiality. For if there should come into your assembly a man with gold rings and fine apparel, and there should also come in a poor man in filthy clothes, and you pay attention to the one wearing fine clothes and say to him, you sit here in a good place, and say to the poor man, you stand over there or sit at my footstool. Have you not shown partiality among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts? Listen, my beloved brethren, has God not chosen the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which He promised to those who love Him? But you have dishonored the poor man. Do not the rich oppress you and drag you into the courts? Do they not blaspheme that noble name by which you were called? If you really fulfill the royal law according to Scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you do well. But if you show partiality, you commit sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. So, a New Testament idea backing this up. It's if the poor man is hated by his own neighbor, then the neighbor is wicked. His heart is not right. He doesn't have this heart that James is talking of there. Wise, righteous people, they respect others, they're merciful to the poor, because this is the way that God is. So they follow the command and the example of their master. Okay. 22 through 24. Do they not go astray who devise evil? But mercy and truth belong to those who devise good. In all labor there is profit, but idle chatter leads only to poverty. The crown of the wise is their riches, but the foolishness of fools is folly. What is the labor of the righteous to be like? What is the work of righteous people to be like? First of all, it's to be done. Right? Righteous people, do they labor? Do they work? Do they seek? to work with their hands, work hard with their hands, that they might have extra to provide for those who are in need. That's we see that idea in Ephesians 4. That's what the righteous do. Their labor is honest labor. They have nothing to be ashamed of. They didn't cheat anybody. They didn't do any wrong. They just simply did good and honest labor. Ecclesiastes 9. If someone will read Ecclesiastes 9, verse 10 for us, and put this idea with it.
Whatever your heart finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work of thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol with which you are going.
Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. Is that the way I do things? Whatever God has given me to do, if it's teaching a lesson, if it's preaching a sermon, if it's leading singing, if it's leading a prayer, whatever I do, do I do it with all my might, or do I just mess around? What do you do? In whatever work you do, whatever you've been found, whatever's been given into your hand to do, how do you do it? Do you do it half-hearted? What does that show? If I do half-hearted workmanship, what does it show?
That you don't really want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, it shows a lack of respect for whoever I'm doing the work for. First thing, if I work for an employer and I just messed around and I just did enough just to eat by, shows a lack of respect for them. Shows that I don't really think the job's that important, apparently.
Shows your laziness.
And it shows laziness. How does God feel about laziness? We've seen it already. He is infuriated by that kind of stuff. He expects diligence. So certainly this is something for all of us, especially when it comes to things that we do for the Lord. When we come together and sing on Wednesday night song services, if I'm just going through the motions, what am I doing? Setting myself up for trouble is what I'm doing. I need to make sure any worship, any service that I give to my Lord, I'm doing it, as I say, with all my heart. Hands full of service. And not this half-hearted stuff, not off the cuff. I need to prepare and be diligent in everything that I do for Him, especially. Good. Verse 25. A true witness delivers souls, but a deceitful witness speaks lies. Bobby, could you read verse 25 in the King James?
Verse 25?
Yeah, Proverbs 14, verse 25.
Okay. A true witness delivers souls, but a deceitful witness speaketh lies.
Okay. Yeah, it's about the same. I was thinking it was a little different in that one. A godly man is a soul winner. What does that mean? A godly woman as well, a godly person. The righteous are soul winners. What does that mean?
They teach the gospel to whoever will listen.
Yeah. And this is not an arrogant claim that we make that we are saving souls. You're simply leading someone to the source that can save their soul. That's the difference. And you know, when you say, well, you need to be a soul winner, don't misunderstand that. Jesus is the one who saves souls. You were simply teaching truth and leading others to Him. And verse 25, a true witness delivers souls. If I am a true witness to my Lord, if I am a true servant of His, I'll teach others. And I'll strive to be a soul winner, as it's said here. Any comments on those?
Well, He has told us when He got ready to go back to heaven, He said for His disciples to go and teach the gospel to every creature. Mm-hmm. If we are His disciples, we're going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Someone will read 26 and 27 for us, please.
In the fear of the Lord, one has strong confidence, and his children will have a refuge. The fear of the Lord is a fountain of life, that one may turn away from the snares of death.
In the fear of the Lord, there is strong confidence, and His children will have a place of refuge. We kind of just talked about this. Our strength, our real strength, is not in and of ourselves. It's in Him. Remember in elementary school, especially, at least I remember growing up, little boys used to argue over whose daddy was the strongest. My daddy's stronger than yours. No, I'm telling you, my daddy could whip all your daddy. So we would talk about it all the time. Spiritually speaking, who is the most powerful father around? Well, physically, however you want to, literally, figuratively, however, who is the most powerful father around? God is. So speaking from a spiritual standpoint, we have the most powerful father there is. We should have confidence in that fact. We should take a lot of comfort in the fact that he is strong, because if he is, when he tells us something, can he make it happen? He can make sure that it will happen, and it won't happen against his will. So there's just a confidence that comes with that. I think verse 26 really points, in fear of the Lord, there is strong confidence. You can trust, because the one who told you is worthy and is trustworthy. Verse 27, Chuck read for us, the fear of the Lord is a fountain of life to turn one away from the snares of death. His word guides us. His providence takes care of us. And then when death does come, one thing that stands out to me, he never leaves his people alone. If you look in Luke 16, when Lazarus dies, how does he go to paradise? You remember? The angels come and carry him there. Even in death, after the threshold of death, God's people aren't alone. He sends someone to take them. That image is, he is with us all through this life. He is with us at death. He is with us throughout eternity. We're never, ever alone. And that's, you know, people fear being alone. And certainly that's a fear worth having. Christians don't ever have to fear that. We will never be apart. As long as we're faithful to him, we'll never be apart from our Father. He's always there with us, comforting us. Chuck.
A great example of that is God, when he led the children out of Egypt, Israelites. I mean, he was always with them in the cloud of the fiery pillar or the cloud of whatever. Yeah. And he provided food and all these things. Even as much as they complained and turned their backs on him, he was still always there for them.
That's a great, great point. I wish I had put that in my notes. The pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire, day or night. He is there with his people. He's there going before his people. So as they go, he's leading them. Great, great example from the Old Testament. Bobby.
Even when the disciple was on this ship with Christ, and he was asleep because he was tired, they thought that the boat would go down.
Yeah.
But he was with them.
Yeah.
They woke him up, and he had a well of their faith.
Yeah. Yep. His presence was there. And then, as you read it, it's like with barely any effort at all, everything is calm in his presence. And he was always there with them. Good. Verse 28. In the multitude of people is a king's honor, but in the lack of people is the downfall of a prince. Certainly a ruler has to consider the needs of his people. If he's selfish, he's going to cause them all kinds of problems. He will lead them into poverty. He'll harm them. And in harming his people, who does a leader really harm? He harms himself. Yeah, you hurt your people as a leader, then you hurt. You bring destruction upon yourself. So certainly a good lesson, obviously, for kings and rulers, but for those who lead in any way. Can I make an application to that as a leader of a household? If I'm selfish, it's going to hurt my people. And if it hurts my people, it's going to hurt me. It's going to hurt the whole family, the whole house. So certainly there's a lesson in that for us as well.
A good leader also knows how to have good people around them.
Yeah.
I mean, a leader don't have to know everything.
No.
But, I mean, think of people here that they're at the church, I mean, with duties. One person may be good at leading singing, where another person may be just excellent at leading prayer. But with them all combined, it keeps us all strong.
Yeah, that's the example that we see in the New Testament. Just the church is like a body made up of different parts. You know, can you do without the ears? I mean, if the body's not going to be as strong as it should be if you don't have the ears. Can you do without the eyes? Can you do it? You know, try doing it without thumbs. You know, they don't seem like a huge part of the body, but you try going a day without them. Are you going to miss them? Obviously, they play an important role. Every part does, and we need to see that and build up whatever abilities we have, whatever talents we've been given. We need to find them and then and build them up, become stronger and be willing to use them so that not only does it help me individually, as Chuck said, it helps the whole church to be stronger and to grow when we're all functioning in the roles we've been given. That's good. 29 through 30. He who is slow to wrath has great understanding, but he who is impulsive exalts folly. A sound heart is life to the body, but envy is rottenness to the bones. Godly people are slow to wrath. They are. They are in control of themselves. They take the situation in and they consider it. That is what wise, godly people do. I think of the traits that we see that elders in the Lord's church are to have. These are to be men who are pillars, who are strong and who are wise, and they are gentle and they are patient. Do they know truth? Do they stand for truth?
Yes.
And yet they're still gentle. So you see they don't just rush in, you know, guns blazing and screaming and hollering. They make sure they have the whole story, and then they do whatever is right. Chuck.
But it's also not necessarily bad for someone to have a temper or someone to get angry. I mean, Christ got angry. There's righteous anger. So just anger within itself is not necessarily a bad thing. It's in what you're angry at and how you react to it.
Yeah, and I think with verse 29, he is slow to wrath. The wrath, the way it's described there, just seems to be completely uncontrolled, just like lava. I mean, just pouring out, consuming everything that's bad. Chuck's point is right, though. I mean, Jesus was angry. He was extremely angry, and he was active in his anger. He did some things, but it was righteous. And he wasn't out of control. It wasn't like Jesus didn't know what he was doing when he was overturning tables there. He knew exactly what he was doing. So this wrath seems to be just a total lack of control. I just give over to my temper and just let it all fly without any kind of control, without any kind of reining it in, and there's no wisdom there. That would go under the second part of verse 29. He who is impulsive, he doesn't think it out. He just snaps and acts before he has the whole story, and he exalts folly. He quickly brings mistakes and trouble onto himself. Good. Verse 30. What is envy?
Strong desire to have something that someone else has.
Yeah, that's it. Strong desire to have something that someone else has, or someone else has something good happen to them, and it just eats me up. And why do they get it? Why don't I get it? Yeah, jealousy and envy, you know, those run together in a lot of ways. And how is envy described in verse 30? It will kill you. It will destroy you. It will just tear and eat away at your body. And spiritually speaking, it'll eat away at your soul. We need to be careful about that. If, especially brethren, if something good happens to brethren, what should my reaction be? Yeah, rejoice with them. And if something bad happens to them, I need to grieve with them. And I, you know, it's a sharing. And so when good things happen to them, I'm glad and I'm happy that it's happening to my brethren. When bad things happen, I try to be there and sort of help bear whatever the burden I can. So this envy has no place in the Lord's church. It has no place. Nothing good will come from it. Very, very dangerous. Rottenness to the bones. Verse 31. He who oppresses the poor reproaches his maker. He who honors him has mercy on the needy. Kind of going back to the idea we talked about in verses 20 and 21. And I just make a quick point on this. To do harm to the poor is to strike a blow against God himself. You know, it's just to heap trouble on someone who already has troubles of their own. If we honor the Lord, we'll be merciful as he is merciful. Let's spend a little time on 32 then. Someone will read verse 32 for us.
Wicked is overthrown through his evil doing, but the righteous finds refuge in his death.
That is a powerful verse. The righteous finds refuge in his death. And so often we may be terrified of the idea of death, but for the righteous, for one of God's children who is striving to be faithful, what is death?
Blessing.
It is. What was that, Matt?
You know, it's going to be something better than what we've got here.
Yeah. Les said it's a blessing. The verse here calls it a refuge. And from what Matt is saying, it's a reward. It's unlike anything that we have. That's how I need to see death. Now, that doesn't mean I need to be foolhardy and jump out in front of trucks or anything, but I don't need to fear it. And it should be the motivation to continue living godly for however much time I have in this life. Death is the goal, in a sense. Because if we are faithful, as Matt mentioned, it is better than anything that we've ever seen, anything we've ever witnessed in this life. If we're faithful, what does the first part of verse 32 say?
Wiggle be over to all their evil day.
Yeah, if you're faithful to the Lord, don't fear death. Don't you dare. It's glorious. It's a refuge. But if you are unfaithful to the Lord, you better take your vitamins and you better eat right and you better work out and you better try to live just as long as you can, because your death is going to be terrifying. It is the exact opposite of all that good that we just talked about. For the unrighteous, for those who would reject God's ways, death is a nightmare that doesn't end. That is terrifying, and certainly that it should scare us. Hopefully it does when we read a verse like this. Joe?
I think an excellent lesson for us is to take Paul's attitude where he stated to die is the gain in his life. Yeah. He's not living, as you just stated, to live indefinitely. He was living to serve man, to do what he could do for man. But as far as Paul was concerned, it will be a happy day for me if I die tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I think if we follow that model, all of our problems would be answered.
Yeah.
That's the righteous lifestyle that, you know, I fail a lot, but I try to mimic it as much as I can.
Yeah. And just that idea of Paul, his idea for the church was, you guys need me to stay alive. Because you need the advice, you need the encouragement, you need the strengthening. But I'm ready to go. I'm ready. When it comes, I'm glad it's here, because I get to go be with my Lord. What a great, great heart and such a godly man that we get to see here. Good. Let's try to move through 33, and then we'll do 34 and 35 together. Wisdom rests in the heart of him who has understanding. But what is in the heart of fools is made known. A wise man, again, going to some other ideas we've talked about, a wise man thinks, he thinks before he speaks. He doesn't even speak to show everybody how wise he is. He thinks, and then when it's needed, he speaks. How does a fool speak?
Blasts.
It explodes. And it doesn't matter if he knows what he's talking about or not, he's still going to talk. That's the difference between a fool and a wise man. Sometimes, is it okay to just say nothing in a conversation and just listen?
Yes.
Yeah, it's okay to listen and just, you don't have to make a comment on every single thing. The fool has no concept of that. The fool has to comment on everything he can, even if he has no clue what he's talking about. And that's usually the case. Verse 34, 35. Let's try to finish up with the few minutes that we have left. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. The king's favor is toward a wise servant, but his wrath is against him who causes shame. Any nation that turns against God is bringing judgment against itself. And when its people just refuse to follow God's ways and do his will, it's bringing judgment. It's just building up judgment against it. We saw it in Daniel 4. Certainly God rules over the kingdoms of men. He puts people into power. He brings people down. And wickedness is what brought about those downfalls. We can just go through with the Assyrians. God raised them up, gave them strength. With the Babylonians, God raised them up and gave them strength. But eventually, they wouldn't turn away from their wickedness and their false gods and self-serving. And he brought them down and replaced them. There is no reason to think he can't do that today. He has done it time and time again. Certainly, we need to pray for our nation. I remember, talked about in grammar school earlier. Let's talk about middle school now. In middle school, you know, little boys are foolish a lot of times. We had a break in between second and third period. And we would go outside and mess around and just walk up and shove each other. And just walk up and shove each other and say, now, what you going to do about it? What you going to do about it? That's foolish, right? But would you do that to somebody who's twice as big as you? You do if you're fool. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you do. Can you imagine walking up to God and say, what you going to do about it? That's exactly what we do as a nation when we refuse to follow His ways. We are just testing His patience. When we take His word and we mock it, or we refuse to keep it, or we put laws into place that go directly against His word, we are shoving Him and saying, now what you going to do about it, big boy? He will do something about it. We don't know when. We don't know how. That is one fight you don't want to pick on the playground. We better be very, very careful in this. Our nation needs our prayers, because there are many in our nation who think they want to fight that fight. It's one of those things when you always had somebody who was, you know, just full of a lot of zeal. Little guy who thought he was going to run up and shove a big guy and get away with it. And the big guy took it for a while. And then he finally clubbed him into the ground because there really wasn't a match there at all. That's what happens if you keep pushing the Creator. We don't want to try His patience. He is patient. He is long-suffering. Peter tells us that. He is long-suffering toward us because He desires that all men be saved. But that patience will come to an end one day. And fiery vengeance will replace it. We don't want to be caught up in the middle of that. The more God blesses, the more He expects. And we see that idea certainly in the Old Testament. You even see it with the idea of the parable of the talents. He blesses and He expects them to use His blessings for good. And then the last point there, verse 35. Good rulers know the value of wise servants. I think this is one of the things Chuck brought out earlier. A wise ruler surrounds himself with wise people. He doesn't have to know everything. He uses the wisdom of those around him wisely. That's a smart man. You don't have to know everything to be a good leader. You just have to be wise. And we talked about the difference between intelligence and wisdom, and that's certainly one of the things there. Okay, any thoughts? Any comments on any of that? Okay, let's stop there. We'll pick up with chapter 15, Lord willing, next week.